So first of all, let me thank the organizer for this nice workshop, for this invitation. My topic is primordial gravitational waves from inflation, and in particular, throughout my talk, these are the questions that I will tackle. I'll be asking what do we expect gravitational waves from inflation to look like? What kind of information can they provide on inflation, and can we detect them, and how? And how do we distinguish the stochastic gravitational wave background from inflation from other backgrounds, either cosmological or astrophysical? So these are the questions I'm interested in. So this slide is mostly to stress that inflation, as we know, predicts a stochastic background to exist. And where it comes from the metric. So this gamma j is what I will be referring to as the transverse and transverse component of the metric, so which in the end corresponds to the two polarization states of the graviton. And during inflation, as we know, the fluctuations are stretched. They become super horizon. They freeze in. And then later on, they re-enter. And if we write down, if we expand Einstein equation linearly, this is what we get on the for gamma ij. And on the right-hand side, I've put under this pi ttij, the anisotropic stress energy tensor. So of course, this is an inhomogeneous equation. So we expect it to have a general solution made up by a homogeneous part, which is what we normally refer to as gravitational waves from vacuum fluctuations in the end. We know how to characterize this. We know what the predictions for the vacuum fluctuations are. I'm going to spell them in a moment. But then, in addition to that, we have, in full generality, we also have a homogeneous solution. And this is what I will be referring to when I talk about gravitational waves from sources. Of course, in the minimal scenario, we only care about the vacuum fluctuations because the solution to the inhomogeneous. Yes? Yeah, I mean, you can think about that, although, quantum fields might enter these objects. So I don't know if I should make that strict distinction. And I'll give some examples. So, yeah, I guess that's it. So, the main message of at least the first part of my talk will be what do we know about gravitational waves from sources? And in order to answer this question, one needs actually a series of lectures because people have been working on gravitational waves from sources for a long time, and there are many examples in the literature. And I will be focusing on some classes of models that, of course, are biased by what I've been working on. But they can be interesting, and so I'm going to focus on those in the first part. But again, this is what I will call gravitational waves from sources.
So these are on-shell particles that are...
Yeah. Well, yes. In the examples that I will describe, they are. Okay, so these are the predictions that we are very much familiar with, and this is what we always think about when we think about, this is what we keep in mind when we think about gravitational waves from inflation. So we take for granted that there is a one-to-one correspondence between the tensor to scalar ratio and the energy scale of inflation. We know how to infer from the energy from the tensor to scalar ratio the scalar field excursion, so we know how to distinguish large field from small field inflation. And then what we know from the vacuum fluctuations is that the power spectrum is red tilted, so there is not much power going towards the smaller scales. And then we know that the two helicities are exactly, they have exactly the same power, so they are non-chiral. And then we expect not much non-Gaussianity from the vacuum fluctuation. So this is the generic predictions if one assumes standard GR. So, okay. This slide is just to remind ourselves what we have at our disposal. So inflation predicts gravitational waves, a gravitational wave background with frequency ranging from very, very small ones, corresponding to a time between wave peaks close to the edge of the universe, to very, very large ones, like 10 to the 8 Hertz. And we have some windows in this range of frequency that we can access with experiments, either indirectly through CMB anisotropies or with interferometers or PTA. And this is what the vacuum fluctuations look like. This is the energy density per logarithmic log of the frequency as a function of frequency, and going from the larger, from the smaller frequency, the smallest to the largest frequencies, is going to go like this because it is, as I mentioned, a red tilted spectrum. And this is for a tensor to scalar ratio, pretty close to the current bounds. And here I've roughly sketched what the sensitivity limits of LISA or advanced LIGO are. So as we can see, they're well above for tensor to scalar ratio close to the current bounds. And one of the questions that I will be asking is whether inflation can predict something beyond the vacuum fluctuations. And so if we could generate something like this or something like this, which could be then of interest for LISA. So when I discuss gravitational waves from sources, this is what I will discuss. But then, so this has to do with the tilt. But during the course of this talk, I will also be challenging these other properties that we take for granted. So the chirality, the non-Gaussianity, and whether this one-to-one correspondence between R and H is preserved, as well as the possibility to infer whether the inflation is large or small field. And the fact is that one or more of these predictions can be violated as soon as one considers the sources. Okay, so this is the outline of my talk. I will start with focusing on sources within this class of axion-gauge field models, which we have partly been hearing about in the previous days. And then the second part of my talk will be about tensor forces, which is another set of signature that refers to a completely separate set of models. It's actually classes of models that can predict these tensor forces signatures and are non-Gaussian signatures. And then probably I'll be out of time by the time I get to the PSD tomography, but I will just mention it so that if people are interested, I'm happy to discuss it. But this is something else that we can rely on if we want to test primordial gravitational waves. And in particular, it's based on cross correlations. So, okay, so throughout my talk, we'll be hearing about different classes of models and different sets of signatures. So let me start with this. Okay, and back to the previous equation. So in this source, depending on your model, you can have different type of fields. You can have scalar, vector, tensors, fermions, as we've heard. Now, in my talk, I will be focusing on tensors. So I'm thinking about the possibility that we have additional tensor fluctuations from other fields, which are going to then source the gravitational waves. And the model that I will be focusing on in this case is the class of models in particular is what we generically refer as axion-gauge field, and we've heard a little bit about this. So these models were partially introduced in the context of natural inflation. In fact, chi in this case is a pseudoscalar field, and is coupled through this Gen-Simon type of coupling to a field strength F, which could be of a U1 or a C2 gauge field. In this case, I will be focusing on the C2 gauge field. But many of the properties that we'll be discussing are common to the U1 as well, some of the properties. So this over here, I've put a very incomplete list of papers which focus on these scenarios during inflation. And it's very incomplete because there is a lot of work. And the reason is that these kind of couplings are interesting for many reasons. So in this talk, I will be focusing on what the predictions for primordial gravitational waves are. But people have been looking at these models also in the context of black holes, baryogenesis, and of course, sea heating, and so on. So let me take a specific realization of these models. And this is a work put forward with Matteo Fasella and Tomohiro Fujita in 2016. And let me just describe the Lagrangian. We have an inflaton Lagrangian, over which we are pretty much agnostic, other than assuming that the inflaton is dominating the energy density of the universe and the inflaton background. And then we have a spectator sector. So we relegate the axion negation field to a spectator sector. And the reason we do that is because we want to have an interesting gravitational wave sector without generating, for example, too much scalar non-Gaussianity and things like that. So we have an axion and then a pseudoscalar field, and then we have an SO2 gauge field. And as I said, this coupling is extremely important because what's happening is that the gauge field is coupled to the axion is rolling, the energy, the kinetic energy of the axion is transferred into the gauge field sector, gauge field quanta are generated. So you have gauge field fluctuations. And because it's an SO2 gauge field, there is a component which is a tensor field with this TAI. And what that implies is that you have a linear source for the gravitational waves. So what happened is the other thing that nice thing that happens in this model is that, well, there are a few nice things that happen in this model. So basically this TAI becomes the source of this equation here. And it is a linear source. So there are a couple of things to say about this. So the first thing is that it is possible to generate gravitational waves from the gauge fields, which are as large, if not larger, than the vacuum fluctuations. And then they look completely different. They are expected to be very different. And I will discuss now what are the properties. So, this plot is just to describe what is happening. So the gauge field are amplified, and as a result, also the tensor modes of the metric are amplified. And one particular feature, which is very important, is parity violation. So in this model, what happens is that only one of the ellipses of the gauge field is amplified. The other one is not amplified, and as a result, the corresponding helicity of the gravitational wave is amplified. So you have a chiral signal. And this is one of the main differences with respect to the vacuum fluctuations. So I've summarized here the three main signatures for these classical models. So I'm gonna discuss the spectral shape, the chirality, and the non-Gaussianity. So I'm gonna put here on the left-hand side the vacuum fluctuations, and on the right-hand side the gravitational waves from gauge fields. So one first feature is that one generically expects some kind of bump in the spectrum of the gravitational waves. And this is as opposed to having a nearly flat red tilted spectrum. And the reason we have this bump is because the gauge fields are being sourced by the axion. And the scale at which the bump occurs really depends on the evolution of the axion. So it depends on the details of your model. In particular, in the model that we proposed, the axion is not the inflaton. So it does not need to roll throughout all the 50 or whatever number of e-folds inflation is lasting. So depending on, for instance, when the field decays, then the bump will occur sooner or later. So that means that the bump could also occur on small scales or on larger scales. And if it occurs on small scales, people have shown in Munich, Ichiro Komatsu and collaborators have shown that it could be as large as what LISA can detect. And of course, this is not there. This is just my cartoonish picture to suggest that, yes, we could have a bump as large as larger than the sensitivity of LISA. So this is one first property. The other property, as I mentioned, is chirality. We expect a chiral signal. So if we have a chiral signal, how do we test it? We can test, depending on where the signal is peaked. If it's peaked at CME scales, we can look for non-zero cross-correlation between TB and EB, which are normally zero, if the signal is non-chiral. And again, Ichiro and his people have done some forecasts on our model showing that if the signal is large at CMB scales and is sufficiently large, then something like LIGHTBER could potentially detect the chirality. And then another question is, what if the signal is large on interferometer scales? And so this is another fun thing to think about, because there is a lot of recent work on this. Well, there is some recent work on this. So can we detect chirality with interferometers is the question. So the first thing that people have known for a long time is that if you have a planar detector and you have an isotropic stochastic gravitational wave background, which is what we normally expect, we're not able to distinguish, to tell if the signal is chiral. And the reason is that if you have an incoming signal from, let's say, the left and incoming from the right, and one is, you cannot distinguish the left polarized coming from one direction from a light polarized coming from the other, as one would expect. One has to disentangle the direction. So there are ways to do that. For example, if we think about, so we basically have to break the planarity of our instrument. And one way to do that, if we think about ground-based detector, because we have a network of ground-based detector which are generally sitting on non-coplanar planes. So one could do a cross-correlation of the signal from different detectors. In the case of our model, this is probably not at the it's not strong enough. The signal is not going to be strong enough to be detected here. In general, what we expect is that it to be detected by something like LISA or Einstein telescope. And when it comes to, for instance, LISA, the space-based detector, the space-based interferometer, something that can be done, because we cannot cross-correlate it with other LISAs, because we have only one LISA in space, we could use the kinematically induced dipole. So basically, in this case, we can use the monopole and do the cross-correlations. For LISA, if we want to use just LISA, we can use the fact that LISA is part of the solar system, so it's moving along with the solar system. Now, if it's moving along with the solar system, then LISA is expected to see an isotropic background because of its motion. So people have shown in this recent work, and early on, Seto showed the same thing, although his results were updated, using the fact that you have this motion, accounting for this motion, basically you break the planarity, and so you become sensitive to the chirality. And if you have a strong enough signal, you can get some bounds on the chirality with LISA. Okay, so the other signature that differentiates this kind of gravitational waves from the vacuum fluctuations is non-Gaussianity, as I mentioned. So when we talk about non-Gaussianity, we think about, for instance, the bispectrum, so three-point correlation functions. And in particular, for the tensors, what the non-Gaussianity will tell us is what the self-interaction of the tensor fluctuations are, or the interactions of the tensor fluctuations with other degrees of freedom during inflation. So in these models, for example, because the tensor perturbations are sourced by the gauge field, you can have additional non-Gaussianity. And again, the Ichiro's group have calculated this, showing that it could be, it is a lot larger than expected in the basic scenario with the inflaton field in slow roll. And in principle, it can be detectable. For instance, they show that this is detectable with Liebert. Okay. Then we also computed scalar tensor non-Gaussianity, and these could also be large, potentially observable with something like CMBS4. So the non-Gaussianity is really the other important signature to we should be after. So to summarize what I discussed so far, when we think about gravitational waves from inflation, we shouldn't just think about the vacuum fluctuations. We should consider the possibility of sources being there. And in the classical models that I discussed, that are interesting for many reasons, it is possible to generate a signal larger than the vacuum fluctuations. And this signal is, in principle, distinguishable thanks to its spectral shape, chirality, and non-Gaussianity. And I'm going to add, so in full generality, another thing that we should focus on is anisotropies. And The question of anisotropies does not apply to the cluster model that I just described, but it will apply to the cluster model which I'm going to go next. So just keep in mind that we want to think about anisotropies in the end. And so this brings me to the tensor fossil signatures. Okay, when we talk about tensor fossils, we think about signatures that have to do with the squeeze non-Gaussianity. So when we talk about squeeze non-Gaussianity, we are referring to non-Gaussianity, which is gives a large signal in the configuration in which the three momenta are such that one is very, very long and the other two are very, very short wavelength. And it has to do with the effect that the long wavelength mode is going to have on the short wavelength modes, on the modulation that it will introduce. And an example of that is the following. So think about the two-point correlation, for instance, density fluctuations. If you assume statistical homogeneity and isotropy, this two-point correlation will generically be equal to a delta function time, a power spectrum which does not depend on direction. So it is going to be diagonal, so it only correlates k1 equal to minus k2. Now, if you have non-Gaussianity, so if you have squeezed, so you have a correlation between these two modes and a very long wavelength mode, this long wavelength mode will affect the two-point function, and in particular, it will introduce a off-diagonal contribution to the two-point function. So the two-point function will have its own leading contribution plus a correction, which is induced by the fact that these three modes are correlated in the presence of a long wavelength mode. So this is what we call fossil signatures, and the reason why we call them fossil signatures is that we normally look at this object, like the power spectrum for the short wavelength mode, or we measure the off-diagonal correlation of the short wavelength mode in order to infer something about the long wavelength mode. So in this case, the long wavelength mode is our fossil field, which we cannot see directly, but of which we can see the effect on the two-point correlation. So one example is the following. Suppose that you have inflation predicts a three-point correlation, like scalar-scalar tensor. So can we use information from scalar perturbations to infer something about the tensor perturbation? So this is the idea that I want to stress. So we want to obtain information on gravitational waves from the scalar perturbations. Now, this is something that we can only obtain if this object exists in the first place and is large enough, and I will be discussing in which classes of models we can expect a signal like this. And just to anticipate, this is not going to be single field slow roll inflation. This is something like that is not observable in single field slow roll inflation because it will be too small in that case. But for now, let me stick to the signatures. So let me give you an example. For instance, if this long wavelength mode is super Hubble, what do we expect? We expect a quadrupolar contribution to the power spectrum for the curvature fluctuations. So in addition to the isotropic part, it is an anisotropic part, which has the form of a quadrupole. And this quadrupole contains information on gamma and on the bispectrum itself. Well, another thing that we can do in principle, using, for instance, galaxy surveys, we can look for off-diagonal correlations between the density fluctuations, and then from there we can estimate the amplitude of gamma. And this is something that we did in this work with Matteo, Dong Wei Zhong, and Marka Minkowski back in a few years ago. And so one can infer the amplitude of gamma from the off-diagonal correlations. Now, something like this similar can be done for if there is a tensor bispectrum, and so one can look at the power spectrum of the tensor modes, for example, to infer something about the non-Gaussianity of the tensor modes. So in this case, for example, we would expect then to see a quadrupolar anisotropy in the power spectrum of the tensor modes. And so what we can do is take the CMB and look for this quadrupolar correction to the power spectrum. So you could say, okay, this is great, but one could also just go and measure the three-point function of the tensors directly in the squeeze limit for the CMB. And that's true. This is just an alternative way of looking at the same thing. But then if one wants to use this technique on small scales, this is actually very important. It does not, it's not just an alternative technique, but it's probably the best or the only way to test the non-Gaussianity. And this comes from the fact, when I say small scale, I say interferometer. So think about doing the three-point function of the time delay of the photon. So will that inform us about non-Gaussianity? The answer is no, because we don't expect to be able to measure any non-Gaussianity directly through the bispectrum on small scales. And the reason is that it's basically the Shapiro time delay and the fact that whatever an interferometer sees a superposition of signals from different directions. So let me do the sketch over here. We have, I'm drawing with the red circle the horizon at re-entry for the gravitational waves, which are then, this is us observing them. So when the gravitational waves re-enter the horizon, they eventually get to the interferometer, but in the meantime, they go through structure. So the gravitons travel in along a perturbed geodesic. And I am I'm writing, this is from a recent paper by this group of people. I am writing the equation of motion of the tensor modes with an additional term here, which is proportional to the curvature perturbation. And this is done in the approximation in which the curvature perturbation is very long wavelength, so in the optical limit. So in this limit, you have something like this. So you have an additional term in the equation of motion for gamma. And what the term does is introduces a delta tau, let's say, which we call time delay, which is proportional to the structure that the gravitons encounter.
So this is linear perturbation theory, and you have zeta times.
Well, it's not linear. Yeah, you have a correction. So this is like the simplest way that we have to account for the fact that the graviton is traveling this perturbed geodesic due to this long wavelength, so this long wavelength gravitational potential. So what these long wavelength perturbations do, they introduce a time delay. And this time delay will depend on the specific direction where the wave is coming from. The consequence of this is that if you go and calculate the three-point function for the time delay, you will get zero. And one easy way to think about it is to think of non-Gaussianity as phase correlation. In this case, you have a decorrelation because every direction is receiving a different phase. So we cannot measure the bispectrum directly with something like LISA, but what we can do is to look for signatures of this kind, which of course are not as satisfactory as measuring the full bispectrum because this is only sensitive to squeeze non-Gaussianity. But I hope I can convince you in the next couple of minutes that squeeze non-Gaussianity is actually very interesting if we want to really understand what inflationary fields are, because single field inflation has no observable effect in terms of squeeze non-Gaussianity. So in a recent paper with Matteo Fasiello, Giammassimo Tasinato, which was just accepted in PRL, we stressed this fact, and we stressed that as far as squeeze non-Gaussianity is concerned, we still have a chance to test it at interferometer scales. So in the next couple of minutes, let me just mention why squeeze non-Gaussianity is so important. And by the way, this is a set of signatures that is complementary to the one that I discussed earlier, because the non-Gaussianity that I discussed earlier in the axion gauge field models is equilateral. So this is it's a different set of models and it's a different set of signatures. So The squeezing externality is crucial because in a single clock inflation, it's observably small. It's not observable. And the reason it's not observable is that the leading order part, the bispectrum, is basically removed by a gauge, can be removed by a gauge transformation. And therefore, whenever we have things in addition to the basic scenario, which could be extra field content or it could be excited initial states, you can have interesting squeezing on Gaussianity. By interesting, I mean in principle observable on different scales depending on the model. Well, another set of models is models with broken space diffs. So in general, squeezing on Gaussianity is a probe for extra field pre-inflationary dynamics or a symmetry breaking pattern which is different from the standard one. So it's very informative on inflation. Okay, so I guess let me just skip to this slide where I want to stress that these are the signatures that we should be after when we talk about primordial gravitational waves. So we should think about what the scale dependence is, the chirality, the non-Gaussianity, and whether there are anisotropies. And it is not an accident that these signatures are also important for distinguishing gravitational waves from inflation from gravitational waves from other sources, because cosmic strings, phase transitions, reheating, and so on, can all be characterized by some of these signatures, and also from the astrophysical background, because especially if we think about LISA, we know that there's going to be an astrophysical background from sources, from stars, and we need to that people have been calculating and are working on it, and will have to be disentangled from the cosmological background. But these are basically the tools that we have at our disposal to distinguish the various backgrounds. And I don't have too much time for this. I mean, I have no time for this. But let me just say that so far I've been mentioning, okay, we can do CMB tests, we can do interferometer tests, but we can do large-scale structure tests to learn more about the primordial gravitational waves. But what we can do is also cross-correlations. And one example is given by this PSD tomography, which is consists in obtaining more information on the large scales by doing cross-correlations of tracers of the electron distribution with secondary CMB anisotropies. So this is something to keep in mind if you want to have more handle on the large scales and therefore have more power to constrain our inflationary model, including primordial gravitational waves. So let me leave you to the summary, and this is based on this work. And so let me give you the summary. Primordial gravitational waves are not, we must think of them not just vacuum fluctuations, so they could tell us more than just the energy scale of inflation. We could tell us about the content of the inflationary era, the field content, and then we are lucky because we have a vast range of scale to test them, and we should go after chirality, spectral shape, non-Gaussianities, and anisotropies, and we should think about cross-correlations as well. That's it. Thank you.
Can you say a bit more about the polarized SC effect?
Sure. I'm happy to. This is the Earth, CMB, last scattering surface. So the photons, the process that we're thinking of is the following. Think about reionization. We have free electrons floating in the universe. The photons are coming from the last scattering surface. They are scattered by these electrons. So because of that, we basically managed to receive more information because the electron will see not just the photons from here, from where our past light cone and their past light cone intersect, but also from the inside of our past light cone. So, okay, the idea is that with these additional anisotropies which are generated in the post-reionization and the reionization, then we can get more information. Now, in practice, what we do is, let me see, I have some backup slides. So we have additional polarization that is generated as a result of that. And if you want to write the expression for that additional polarization from the scattering, it's going to depend on the number density of the electron, and it will be an integral over the line of sight. So all the electrons that the photon is encountering will scatter, will generate polarization, and will contribute to the Stokes parameter. So what we want to do, so if one writes this expression, it will depend on a quantity that is related to the what we call the remote quadrupole, which is the quadrupole that the location of the scatterer, the location of each electron. So it will depend on the Komovin position. And what we would like to do is to extract information on the remote quadrupole. And now this remote quadrupole is in an integral. So in order to do that, we can do the cross correlation of the secondary polarization. Secondary because I'm considering the density, the contribution from the anisotropic number density of the electrons, because that's like the small scale effect that we're after, with some tracer of the electron number density. And if we do that, we extract the quadrupole at that particular redshift, if our tracer of the electron number density is a function of redshift. So that way we do a map of the remote quadrupole. Well, in principle we do, because this is something that we can tackle with future surveys like CMBS4, so we can combine the power of CMBS4 with, for instance, LSST, and we can do a map of the remote quadrupole. And in our case, in particular, then if we assume we have that map, we can combine E and B mode component of the remote quadrupole with the primary polarization information, and then that way we have more information on the large scales. Sorry, I hope my answer was not too long.
Questions?
Thanks for the very nice talk. I have a couple of questions. So, to what extent is it crucial for some of this phenomenology that you have SU2 gauge fields and not U1?
Mm-hmm.
Is it crucial because this is the reason why the spectrum goes up and then goes down, so you have a bump?
No,
not really.
No, that's not the reason. So the fact that the bump does not need to occur at the end of inflation is related to the fact that we are separating the spectator sector from the inflaton sector. But your question is very important, and because for the UN models turn out to be a lot more constrained, and so I think there are two main reasons. One is Schwinger pair production. You can have So the gauge field sector can be depleted if Schwinger pair production occurs, that people have demonstrated in some cases. And this is an effect that is a lot stronger for the U1 field than for the SU2 field. And it has to do with the fact that the SU2 is massive. And so it is more difficult for this process to occur in that case. And the other thing is, the mechanism is linear production for the SU2, and is a quadratic for the U1, and so that affects the phenomenology. Yeah, and in general, it's easier to steer away from the scalar sector in the SU2 rather than U1, precisely because you cannot have a linear sourcing of the scalar perturbations, but you can have a quadratic source of the scalar perturbation from the gauge field, from the same mechanism that sources the gravitons, basically.
Thanks. And the other question or comment, if you want, when you are talking about bi-spectrum, so you mentioned one aspect why it is very difficult, if not impossible, to measure bi-spectrum actually at interferometers.
Yeah.
But there's another aspect, which is phase erasing, due to the fact that all these gravitational waves, they enter the Hubble radius already long time ago.
That's right.
And they've oscillated a lot.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, in this particular squeeze scenario that you say survives somehow,
yes,
the other problem.
They survive if the long wavelength model has not undergone that evolution. So if, in fact, the signatures that I'm talking about is ultra squeezed, And in particular,
so
we have to assume...
So you are talking really about something crossing the,
exactly,
the entire universe.
Exactly. If the long wave remote undergoes the evolution, then again, but, you have the same problem.
Okay.
Yeah, so if it's...
Okay, that's why you see a spatial modulation, but you are not seeing the bias spectrum directly. Okay,
that's right.
I see. Good.
That's right.
Thank you.
I have a question related to Denny's first question. Could you cut out the gauge field entirely and just couple the pseudoscalar directly to gravity through phi rr tilde, which presumably would also produce chiral gravitational
waves?
Yeah,
people have been working on models where you have I guess some people call it CC tilde, but I guess you're referring to the Weyl tensor, right?
Or the, yeah, some combination
yeah.
of
Yeah, yeah, you can do Weyl some tensor. Modification of your, some modification like that, and in that case, for sure you get some chiral signal, yeah.
Because I guess in that case, in terms of your master equation, it probably wouldn't show up as a source term, but rather as a modification of the dispersion relation on the left side.
Yeah, I think so.
So maybe there's some way of generalizing this philosophy of introducing sources in addition to the vacuum contribution. You could also have other ways of playing
yeah.
with the dispersion relation
yeah,
on the left side
yeah,
of the equation.
Yeah, in everything I've done, I've assumed that you know, we have the sun, the usual gravity, but yeah, you can do some. Definitely, you can do something, as you say.
Other questions?
I must have a comment on Danny's first question also. So it's, I mean, the fact that you have a bump is related to the fact that you take the cosine potential for the action, right? So if you relax that, you can even have even weirder spectra.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you get an actual action monodromy with an oscillating part, you get an oscillating B mode spectrum, power spectrum. So it's
mm-hmm.
it's even richer than just mm-hmm. a bump. You can go crazy.
Yeah,
with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. We kept it minimal, but
yeah,
you're right.
Yeah.
If you start modifying the potential of the axon, you can have a lot more, variety. I agree.
Other questions? If not, let's thank Emma again.